Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There's a new sheriff in town. Former CMPD Detective Gary McFadden was sworn in last month as Mecklenburg County's first African-American sheriff, one of seven African-American sheriffs elected in the state's seven largest counties: Mecklenburg, Wake, Guilford, Forsyth, Cumberland, Durham, and Buncombe. McFadden spent three decades at CMPD, ending his career there, helping to build community relations at a time when tensions with police here and around the country boiled to the surface. He appears to be following a similar path at the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office. One of the first things he did as sheriff was to follow through on a campaign promise to end the department's participation in the federal 287G program, which cooperated with ICE to report on immigration status of inmates in the county jail. That was a controversial move for some, and we'll talk about that this hour, along with other plans as sheriff, as we welcome Gary McFadden to the program. Thank you for being back with us.
Thank you for having me again.
You had a different color uniform on the last time.
Just for today. It won't last long.
If you'd like to join our conversation, you're welcome to. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, get to WFAE on Facebook, or through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can watch us this morning on Facebook Live. So let's start with your decision to end the 287G program. You ran against former Sheriff Irwin Carmichael, who was a staunch supporter of 287G. Why did you feel so strongly that the program was wrong for Charlotte and needed to be ended?
Well, you know, I spent three decades at CMPD. About two and a half of those decades were actually on the ground in the community trying to solve homicide investigations. During that time, you know, the residents of Charlotte were reluctant to come to help be witnesses on cases. And the Latino communities or the immigrant communities or undocumented residents of this community was more reluctant to come forward. We had victims of crimes, was very afraid of law enforcement, didn't want to talk to law enforcement. I worked personal cases that you probably know the suspects or the victims, and they didn't want to come forward. It did not build community trust. So I was a staunch opponent not to keep it in my house.
Okay. For people who may not be familiar with 287G, how did it work?
Well, it was a voluntary part of ICE came to the sheriff's office to say, can you help us? So believe it or not, I think the sheriff's office did the bulk of the work, where the inmates or the people who were confined to the jail who came in was arrested by local law enforcement. At that time, after being arrested by local law enforcement, the deputies would tell ICE that they would be in jail. Then it would bring a detainer instead of a criminal warrant, and then it would hold people in jail for a while. And we were just having people there, and we did the bulk of the work, and that's not our job.
So the work was that you, the sheriff's department, prior to your arrival, would ask about the documentation status of individuals in the jail, whether they were citizens, whether they were immigrants, whether they're here legally or not. And if they discovered that these were undocumented people, they would turn that information over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. And then what would happen? They would just be detained for a long time, or would they automatically be snatched out of the jail and deported?
Well, we still ask the questions. We still provide the information. We still have that information available through different databases at the Law Enforcement Center. So we didn't take that away.
So what's changed?
Just that we are not involved. The sheriff's office is just not doing what ICE agents should be doing at the jail. We just don't do that work anymore. Our job is to be in the community. Our job is to enforce state and local laws.
So it's Monday morning, and perhaps my brain is a little foggy from 2 days off. I don't understand. Explain to me what happened at the department before that isn't happening now. You're still asking the question, are you here documented? Are you a legal immigrant to the country?
They would bring a detainer.
What does that mean?
Detainer is pretty much like, for the average listens, a document that an ICE agent would bring to the sheriff's office 24 hours, a couple of hours after we arrested him, and say, could you detain this young man or woman?
And they knew to bring that detainer because?
They believe that this person is illegally.
How did they know that person was arrested?
Well, we notify them.
Okay.
And they are still being notified, and they're always going to be notified.
So tell me what's different.
That we don't do their job.
They
do. We don't do the documentation. We don't do the paperwork. We notify them. We arrest them. We arrested. Well, the local agencies arrest them, bring them in. All the stuff goes into the system, database. Mm-hmm. And ICE should be aware of that in the database. If they check the database, they would find that.
Why are they so upset? Because after you said you were going to eliminate that program, Sean Gallagher with the Atlanta Field Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement said that your action is an open, this is a quote, open invitation to aliens who commit criminal offenses, that Mecklenburg County is now a safe haven for persons seeking to evade federal authorities. And he added that residents should expect a more visible ICE presence in Charlotte, meaning there was going to be a crackdown. I don't know if that's occurred or not, but that's they felt threatened by this.
Well, that's his opinion of it.
But I don't understand what's the difference.
That's his opinion of what they believe that they need to do. I don't think they're going to do anything differently. They know that they're in the community. They know that they are doing what they need to do in the community. It's just that they believe that we need to do their job, and we're not.
Okay. And you're not alone in this. There are sheriffs, other sheriffs recently elected.
Well, you have to look at across the country. There is about 13,000 law enforcement agency across the country. With this new removal of 287G, it is about 70 to 75. If this is what's a great tool, mm-hmm. then I believe that everybody else would have joined in.
So if I understand this correctly, when 287G was in place at Mecklenburg County's jails, more than 15,000 people were impacted by this. 15,000 people were processed for deportation since the program was instituted. How many were actually deported?
Well, I think ICE would tell you something like 20,000, but then we look at them as if they were serious crimes. You know, I think that the program was designed to target very violent offenders, homicide cases, robbery cases, rape cases, drug cases. But if I think you look at the data that ICE put out in their 2017 report, it does not reflect that. And I think my predecessor would also say that DWI and assault on the females were the top number. So,
And also, if I'm not mistaken, money changed hands when 287G was in place between ICE and the Sheriff's Department. In other words, there was compensation for you, quote, to use your words, you doing their job for them. There was compensation for that, right?
Well, I don't know about the compensation. I don't know how much of money went back and
you
forth.
You don't know, really?
No, I don't. I don't know how much money went back and forth with that.
Really?
No.
Why not?
It's not part of mine. It's part of his.
You talked about trust being one of the reasons, and you're not alone in this either. Kerr Putney, the CMPD chief, believes that 287G destroys trust between police and law enforcement and members of the community, and other law enforcement people around the country have said something similar to that. But if 287G is gone, but the same thing is still happening with reporting to the immigration status of inmates to ICE, ICE doing it themselves, what's the difference? How does that build trust? Because they still have ICE still has access to the information about the people in your jails. What's the difference?
We're going to build trust. The law enforcement agencies, such as Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office, is going to build the trust. Whatever ICE does, you know, we're still going to be cooperative with them. I don't have any bad blood for ICE. We're still going to work with ICE. I've had many meetings with ICE prior to taking this job, and hope to have them afterward. It is up to us to build trust in the community. If ICE and Homeland Security doesn't want to build it, we're going to build it.
But if I am an undocumented immigrant, I'm not here legally. I didn't go through channels. And I find myself in your jail for whatever reason. I ran a red light. I have a broken taillight. I committed some other offense that's maybe a more violent crime, a petty larceny, whatever. And I'm in your jail. Why do I trust you more today than I did when Sheriff Carmichael was in charge and he was operating 287G for ICE if ICE can still find out from you my immigration status?
Because I'm going to be in the community to build that trust. I think that's the big difference. I'm going to be in the community to educate the community that was not happening in the last administration, and I don't think it happened any part of when 287G was here. I'm going to be in the community talking to the citizens, the residents of the community, the undocumented immigrants, and educate them and also educate the community who does not know a lot about this.
Hmm. The Federation for American Immigration Reform, which opposes illegal immigration, says the end of 287G here and around the country at sheriff's departments and jails compromises public safety because the program helped law enforcement agencies to share information. Why are they wrong?
We are still sharing information. We will always share information. We have NCIC and all of the databases to share the information. I have great support around the country, in the city, and I believe that we go back to the same thing. About 78 law enforcement agencies have 287G. So if you ask the other thousands of law enforcement agencies, does it bring harmony to the community? Does it bring trust in the community? Why don't they use that tool? They don't use the tool. I'm not going to use that tool, and it shouldn't be the only tool in the box. Mm.
So despite I don't want to call it a threat, but the cantankerous nature of Sean Gallagher with ICE's comments about the end of 287G and a potential crackdown in Charlotte because the sheriff's department was no longer cooperating with 287G, you still have what you have described as a working relationship with ICE. How would you describe that relationship? Are you hearing from them in private meetings what we heard publicly from Sean Gallagher with the Atlanta field office of ICE?
I've received a letter from Sean, and I've talked to Sean, and Sean has come to Charlotte to visit, and I welcome him back to Charlotte. I don't have a problem with Sean coming to Charlotte. I have a jail that needs to be utilized, and we will still utilize my jail with the proper documentation brought to me, and we will take care of the residents and the citizens of Mecklenburg.
So a lot of people have said that your resounding victory in the election, which led to your becoming the sheriff, and also the similar results in sheriff races in Buncombe and Durham counties, is a result of the promise to end 287G. What does that tell you?
It is not our only promise that we made to the community. I don't want people to believe that we won these races just because of 287G. We won these races because we were from the grassroots part of the community. Most of the counterpartners of what we're talking about, these seven individuals or six with myself, we have always been on the ground. We worked in the communities. I have even worked with some of these sheriffs in the community. So don't let it be solely on 287G. We are out, we are about, and we're still working in the community. People just took that as part of it. I think this is something to distract us from what we're really going to do in the communities across this country.
If 15,000 people were apprehended by ICE because of 287G, how many people have been asked about by ICE of your department since you took over in December?
Well, I don't have those numbers.
Okay.
I don't have those numbers.
There's other things to talk about other than 287G.
It is. It's the community. It's other violence. It's a lot we could talk about.
And we're going to talk about it.
I hope we do.
Sheriff Gary McFadden is with us. He's the new Mecklenburg County Sheriff. Took office December the 4th, if I'm not mistaken. And we will continue our conversation in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest is the recently elected Gary McFadden, the new Mecklenburg County Sheriff, spent years at the police department and is now the sheriff as of December the 4th. Your predecessor, also a Democrat. You beat him in the Democratic primary, and there was no Republican opponent, so the victory in that primary led to your becoming sheriff. He rose through the sheriff's department. I believe Sheriff Carmichael started there as a volunteer. You spent your career as a police officer, a detective at CMPD, and I think you were there for 30 years, a detective and leader on community relations through CMPD. Do you think that your experience in law enforcement as a police officer has given you a different point of view than perhaps somebody whose experience was entirely at the sheriff's department?
Yes, it is, because mine was in the community, talking to people every day, engaging with people every day, helping with initiatives to help the community, talking, being there, going to the churches, going to the schools, which I still do and which I'm going to do after I leave here today.
Right.
Connected with the community, answer the phones. Probably, as people say, I'm too much connected and too accessible to the community.
Are you the end of the road? In other words, as a police officer, you're out there building relationships with the community, stepping in where needed, arresting people where needed. And then when they are arrested and processed, they go to jail and they go to the sheriff's department's jails, right? Are you the end of the, you're the backstop. You're the end of the road.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Okay.
I would say I'm the continuation of their life. I'm going to help them get back on the road. It's a small detour when they come to my jail. So I've had a great time in these last 30 days. I've had my incarcerated citizens writing letters asking me when I'm coming to their floor. I'm into the jail at least twice a week, having these conversations. I'm going to call them pod talks, where I sit down and actually talk to the men and women.
Let's talk about that for a second, because as a police officer, I would think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that once you arrest somebody and they're processed and they go off to the jails, you're just kind of like that. Whereas now you are charged with maintaining their lives while they're in that jail until they go through the court system and wherever they end up after that. Has this, I mean, you've only been on the job for 30 days, but has the experience of having these meetings changed your point of view about the people in our jails?
Yes, it has.
How?
Well, rehabilitation, not stripping people of their human dignity, not dropping a pair of flip-flops and an orange jumpsuit that says Mecklenburg County Jail at their feeding and stripping them of their human dignity and then all of a sudden trying to give them that dignity back, giving them respect. Somebody said something to me that I'll never forget. How do you want me to prepare your neighbor? Because they're coming out. They're going to come out one day. And how do you want me to prepare your neighbor? How do you want me to prepare that person who's going to serve you that meal at your fine restaurant who's in the kitchen staff?
Mm.
So for me, it's just having conversations with citizens who are incarcerated.
So your approach to this is a 180 from that of former Sheriff Arpaio in Arizona, who put them in pink jumpsuits and humiliated his inmates as best he could. You think, you know that these people are coming out.
They're coming out. At some point, they're coming out, and we should have them prepared for their future.
And once again, you've only been in office for 30 days, and you haven't met with everybody who's incarcerated in the jail yet. But when you do, when you have met with these people, do they know? I'm not sure how to phrase this question, but do they know that they screwed up somehow? And if they had it to do over again, they wouldn't. Or if they were given a second chance, they think they wouldn't. How have you come away from these?
Well, I think we have to say, I wouldn't even say a second chance. Have they ever been given a chance?
A chance.
A lot of them have never been given a chance.
Okay.
And I think that I'm going to try to help them get that chance. One of my things that I want to do that this summer, I want to have a job fair inside the detention center. So the employers who will come will know where we're starting with these people. And giving them a chance, not a second chance, a chance for the first time. Talking to people to find out where they are, what they missed through life. That's different from
I'm sorry.
That's different from previous sheriffs.
Studies have shown that employers who hire formerly incarcerated individuals have a pretty good they're hiring people who will end up doing a pretty damn good job because they don't want to go back. They know what it was like before they had a job and what they had to do to survive, and they don't want to go back into that environment. And yet, employers are more reluctant to hire formerly incarcerated individuals. What would you say to people?
Well, that's when I come in to help educate the employer. You're still going to hire someone. Give someone who's going to be dedicated because they believe that they are giving a chance. I like to have those conversations with those employers to say, give me a chance, and to give someone else a chance. I think we'll start there with that.
After 30 years in the police department, why did you want to be the sheriff?
I listened to the community. I listened to the community wants. I listened to the community needs. I've had long conversation with advocates, people from both sides, and I prayed about it, got guidance, and said, I'm going to do this. I'm that person that I know can make a difference, mm-hmm. I know can make a change, and I have the time to do it.
Got guidance from?
God.
In what way?
Pray about it. You pray about this. This is a very unique task. It's a very difficult task. It's a very brutal task. It's a very demanding task. It's a very timely task. But when you hear someone say this, you are my hope. You are my hope. Go back and save someone. Bring someone that chance, that first chance or that second chance. I've dealt with many people who have been previously incarcerated. They are my friends. A lot of them, you know, supported me during the campaign and definitely supporting me now. I listen to them. They are the consumer of some of the products that we're talking about. So we listen to them to say, did these programs actually work for you? No, this program will work for me.
If we plucked a random police officer off the street, would he have the same opinion of the people he has to arrest, he or she has to arrest?
I would doubt it.
Where did it come from in you?
Years of looking at it through different glasses, seeing kids disadvantaged, seeing the poverty in the neighborhoods, actually going and listening to people. I think that we have to step back. CMPD does a great job. The community relations, I would say, one of the best in the country. And I'm a product of that. And I'm hoping, well, let me change that. I'm hoping that the officers from CMPD, you would find them to say the same thing that I'm saying, that we are connected. We're going to go out. We're going to take that extra step. I think that's the part that we miss. Trust. Do they trust us? The media, where we at in the nation with all of this, the media puts a different light of what we are as law enforcement or what we could be.
Meaning?
Slanted a little bit. We're the guys who wants to beat you. We're the guys who wants to shoot you. We want to do all these things.
How does the media
We talk about things often. We talk about a lot of what we do wrong, but we don't talk about what we do right a lot of times. And I think that's, you know, we have just as many problems as anybody else. There's a lot of officers die every year.
But isn't the problem with that is that nobody's taking a cell phone video of police officers helping a homeless person get off the streets?
They could.
They could, but they don't. And so what we see is a cell phone video of police officers mistreating people, many times mistreating people that they come into contact with. Is that the media's fault, or is that simply because that video is available and by God it happened, so let's show it?
Well, I think that we can change it. You have the ability to do it as media. We can do these stories if you like. Mm-hmm. We talk about many things. We talk about this 287G, but nobody says, let's talk about how many families saw their loved ones during the Christmas time that I allowed them to have face-to-face.
Well, let's talk about it, because that's where I was going next.
Well, that's a great place.
Because prior to leaving office, Sheriff Carmichael had ended, your predecessor had ended in-person visits between inmates and family members and friends and replaced those visits with video visits. The company came in and installed video monitors in the pods, And if you were a family member, you could be on the other side of the camera and talk to your incarcerated loved one. He was on this program, Sheriff Carmichael was on this program right after that decision was made, and he said that video visits had the potential of increasing the amount of contact inmates could have with their families because those visits did not require supervision. Personnel no longer had to move inmates to a certain location to have these visits, and the visits could take place at the convenience of visitors rather than on the schedule set by the department. And then he said that those visits also increased security because they eliminated the possibility of contraband finding its way into the jails. Do you believe that video visits are a part of this, or just a...
Video visit is a part of mine, okay. Where a mother would be in Nevada, and her loved one is arrested here, and she can't get here. We still have video visitation for that.
Okay.
I believe that talking to a loved one face-to-face, which I have personally witnessed during Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, I saw a young man to see his daughter 2 months old for the first time. I saw that reaction. Mothers thanked me as they left the jail or the detention center when I was downstairs. I greeted them as they came and as they left. And we talked about small things, and they were very thankful. So I personally saw it firsthand. It wasn't the data that we're talking about. I saw it. I love it, and I'm going to continue it.
So you reinstituted the policy at least for the holidays. When will you reinstitute it for on a permanent basis?
I would say next month. Small tweaks that we have in it, a little bit more moving staff around. I even saw staff happy. You know, when they walked the young man to see his daughter, there was a different conversation when he was being walked back.
Humanizes people.
Humanizing people. And you think about it. We want to see our loved ones every day, correct? Mm-hmm. So why not them?
When you, when people come to visit in these in-person situations, aren't they still behind a plexiglass window?
Yes, they are.
They can't sit at a table and hold hands or touch each other. Why not?
Well, we may
How
get...
How dangerous are these people?
Well, we're going to get... I'm hoping to get there one day. I'm hoping to have that. I'm hoping to have fathers read to their children. Mm. I hope mothers can hold their children. When I went to see the young ladies at the North Jail and had pod talk with them and sat down and had a conversation with them, a mother said it was great to see her daughters after a year. But how great would it be if she could hold her daughters or read to her daughters?
Well, other jurisdictions do allow that because you see, the closest I've been to that is watching it on TV or in the movies, but you see these group rooms, these big open rooms with families on one side of a table and the inmates on the other side of the table. Why don't we do it that way? Why haven't we done it that way?
I'm not sure why somebody else didn't, but we are going to move in that direction also.
What security concerns are there surrounding that kind of visit versus visiting between a piece of plexiglass and the video monitor visits?
You would have a security concern. I think that comes with training. Training the detention officers on how to properly search people as they come in, search their items.
But if you're on the other side of a piece of plexiglass, is there any possibility of contraband passing from the visitor to
the inmate? Well, no, currently there's not. There's no way. I've viewed it. I've looked at it.
So what was Sheriff Carmichael talking about?
I have no idea. You have to ask him.
Okay, and I guess one of the security concerns was the fact that officers had to lead the inmate from the cell or the pod to a place where that person could be on the other side of plexiglass. Is that a security concern? Is it difficult to move a person from one place to another in the jail?
No, it's not. I've viewed that about four or five times. I've talked to my unit called the DART unit, which is a wonderful group of guys. I met them at morning meeting. We've had these conversations. And, of course, we have to tweak a little bit, but that is part of their job as detention officers to move people throughout the detention center.
And getting back to one of the other things that Sheriff Carmichael said was that these video visits allowed people essentially to visit 24/7, whenever they wanted to. They could get on the other end of that call and and be there. It didn't require an appointment, didn't require scheduled hours. Is that true? And will that continue even with the in-person visits?
Well, we're going to still allow them to visit through video. You know, some people want to do that. Some people can't get down. Some of the people are elderly, and they can't make it to see their grandkids or loved ones. So we're going to allow that. So they're still going to have that option. But then we're going to have to look at that cost of that also, because it's a cost involved.
You have said that allowing inmates who you refer to as residents, if I'm not mistaken, to allowing residents to stay connected to family and loved ones through in-person visits improves public safety.
It does.
How so?
It connects the families again. I can tell you that. It connects the family. They have conversations with their loved ones of the do's and the don'ts, and I wish you would not do this, or I wish you could do that. It gives them a future. It gives them hope.
So when mama is sitting on the other side of the glass, or the wife, or the husband in some cases, sitting on the other side, that has an impact?
I believe it does.
More than you telling them they shouldn't do this?
Well, it's the same thing that when a mother talks to a son at home.
Yeah.
A wife talks to a husband at home. It's that conversation. The video is very poorly. It's poor. I have been told that it's poor. Sometimes they can't even see it. It's grainy, the connection process and all. So, but having that conversation that I have witnessed personally over the last month is great.
You've also said that these in-person visits have been shown to, and this is a quote, significantly lower the chances that a person will commit another crime after they get out, and reduces the chance that a person will commit an infraction while inside the jail. And you've said that these visits improve mental health outcomes and strengthen family units and community ties. You've witnessed this?
I've witnessed it.
You have facts to back that up?
My eyes are the facts. I've witnessed young men saying, I love this. I can't wait till next week. I can't wait to see my daughter. Mother said, you know, I can't wait to see my son again. We've had a great conversation today. He get to see his daughter for the first time. He get to see his son for the first time. So he looks forward to that again.
Yeah.
And he's going to build a future with that.
There's a company called GTL that's out of Virginia, and they're the company that installed those video visit devices in the Mecklenburg County jails. And do all visits have a charge? Because they were charging, I think, $12.50 for 25 minutes with one free visit per week. Is that right?
Yes. And I think after your show, my predecessor decided to add another one.
Okay.
Yes.
So that money will be decreasing if you increase the number of in-person visits. Are they going to yank those machines out because they're not making enough money on them?
We're having those conversations now.
Okay. Sheriff Gary McFadden is with us. We have more to talk about, and we'll do that when we come back on the other side of the break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
If you've ever thought to yourself, I should make a podcast, now is your chance. WFAE is proud to present the Queen City PodQuest, the search for the next great podcast from Charlotte and the surrounding areas. Learn more and submit your idea by January 27th at wfae.org/Queen City PodQuest.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mecklenburg County's new sheriff, Gary McFadden, is with us. He's been on this program before, but formerly as a police officer with CMPD, as a community relations police officer, formerly a detective with CMPD, and now on the other side of the equation, I guess is the way to say it. You are opposed to solitary confinement. And I was reading yesterday about our practices with regard to solitary confinement, and I knew nothing about this. It actually surprised me.
Well, it would surprise a lot of people. That's why we are going to talk about it in the community more, and we're going to give them our new policy when we finish it and tell them what we're going to do with it.
How extensively have we been using solitary confinement, and who are the people who are confined in that manner?
Well,
what have they done?
We confine youth offenders, and we confine
all
adults.
Of them, or just some of them?
We confine some of them. I mean, when they do a break a law or a policy inside the jail, or for some other reason, a deputy sees that they need to be in solitary confinement, they are placed in solitary confinement. We are reviewing how you get to solitary confinement.
Are they in have they been in solitary confinement for their own protection or because they can't get along with other inmates and they're causing trouble in the pod? Why are they there?
Both, some for protection.
What kinds of, is it violence, physical violence?
The ones that I've seen, some of it is. Some of it are what I consider petty.
And how long are they generally in solitary confinement?
Usually 23 hours in, 1 hour out.
So for how long?
Well, it depends on the violation and the policy.
Describe solitary confinement at Mecklenburg County Jails.
Well, previously it was that you go to a pod. They place you inside the cell for 23 hours. After that,
how big's the cell?
I'm not sure the square footage. I've seen it, but didn't pay that
small.
Much. It's small. It's small. No windows. Steel door. A small window to look out.
Does the light go off? Night.
I think you can turn your own lights on, and I mean, what is controlled?
Okay.
Yes,
you can control your own lights. And you're there for in the cell for 23 hours, and then you're allowed out for 1 hour of what? Exercise.
Exercise. Walk around.
And are you alone during that
no,
hour?
No, you are supervised. You are supervised, I mean, from a distance. You could be supervising this small rec area.
Are they allowed to have reading material in solitary confinement?
Not sure. Some have reading material. They would have reading material. That is correct. They would have reading material.
Well, because evidently in September of last year, the sheriff's office said it eased restrictions for 16 and 17-year-olds being held in solitary confinement at Jail North. Evidently, if I read this correctly, for years, teens who fought or stole or broke jail rules were held alone in that windowless cell that you have referred to with no access to phones, visitors, or library books. But in September, the sheriff began letting those offenders out of their cells 4 hours a day and planned to ease restrictions on adult inmates in solitary, letting them out 2 hours a day. I know you haven't formulated completely your new policy on this, but can you give us a preview of what you're thinking?
Well, the preview is that we need to look at our youthful offenders. They're 16 and 17 years old. Are we giving them the help that they need? Are we hurting them or helping them by giving this solitary confinement? I want to do away completely with youthful offenders being solitary confined in the Mecklenburg County Jail. Before the Christmas holidays, we work with the kids. Worked with the youthful offenders from the time that I got there until January. We do not have any youth in DDU or solitary confinement.
What is DDU?
It's the same thing as solitary confinement.
Okay.
It's what my predecessor had called it, but it's solitary confinement. So I went to the staff and said, I want them to work with these young men. I don't think there's any women were there. And I personally sat down with these four or five young men who were there at the time. And I asked them, can they work with me on this transition of removing them from this state back to general population or better confinement area? They all agreed. So for the last month, we've been working with them. And on December 31st, they all transitioned back out into another populated area. I went and had a conversation with them, sat down with, again, one of the pod talks and everything else. And one guy received a gift. He received the Quran from me. He had read the entire Bible, and he asked me, can I provide him with a Quran? So we got him one. I signed it, gave it to him, and we're moving forward with these four or five young men to better their lives and put them on a better path.
Is a lot of the problem that you encounter with people in jails who get themselves into trouble while in the jail, is it because it's does it all boil down to respect?
To get to jail?
No, when they're in jail and they're having troubles that will land them in solitary confinement, they get themselves into trouble. They have altercations. Is it about respect?
No, it's many things.
Okay,
it's conflict. It's no conflict resolution measures. It is some respect, but it's a number of things.
So now that you're going to end this policy, or at least make it more lenient, have fewer people in solitary confinement for shorter amounts of time, how are you keeping them out of trouble? How are you helping them stay out of trouble?
Today, I'm having a meeting with my staff at Jail North, they need to provide more than what they have been providing these young men and women. Life skills. We talk about life skills all the time. We talk about life coaches. We talk about rehabilitation. So we're going to provide them more. You ask them, what are you missing? You know, I don't think you just throw someone in solitary confinement for 23 hours and said, okay, what happened? How did you get here? I think we need to have these conversations. I find that having these conversations with these men and women have been very educational for me and very helpful for me.
What did you learn?
That nobody really talks to them. Nobody really cares. Listen to their small problems that can escalate to larger problems. And I think that's the same thing happens to our youth while they're under our roof at home.
When you say nobody listens to them, is that nobody listens to them in the jail or nobody has ever listened to them, even on the outside?
Both, outside and in the jail. If you think about where our young adults now, they're on iPads every day. They're on iPhones every day. How many times did you have a conversation with your children about just general stuff, have a talk at the dinner table or just a talk? So communication is key, finding out where they're at. You know, do we listen to our kids' music to know why they're listening to it? Somebody else is talking to them. Why don't we talk to them? We don't do that very much. And I found out that talking with these men and women who are incarcerated here has been very educational to me. I learned much more from them than any data, any report, any books. Because you think about, to generate these reports and data that we often talk about, somebody had to talk to a group of people to generate that.
Yeah.
So I get a chance to do that each and every day.
This is a new approach.
It is.
At least it's different from your predecessor's approach. What kind of buy-in are you getting from the people under you, for the other officers who have to be in contact with these folks every single day?
Well, it's a difficult transition because it's new. We're going to have to change their mindset. I think that personally being engaged with the incarcerated citizens is a little different. You know, have conversations. It reduces conflict with them. You know, what I witnessed with people walking these young men and women back when they're visiting the family, the conversations going back to their cells were different. I know that were different because, you know, that's my history of dealing with these men and women in my past life. The conversations, I've talked to the staff. They even said it was a good thing. Mm. Now, maybe not all of them, and we're going to try to get everybody on board.
I'm going to guess that a lot of this philosophy comes from your experience at CMPD in community relations. You helped start the Cops and Barbers program, which is a program that helps build trust between police and the community, which has been pretty successful. And now you're running the jails. And one of the things that I know you want to talk about is engagement. Ongoing engagement.
It is.
Not these conversations that we have between police and the community in the aftermath of some horrific event, but all the time.
That is what I want. You have to have these conversations. We do, myself and Sean Corbett did, and Gene Winchester and some other people created Cops and Barbers. We saw where that was an avenue into the communities because every community has a barbershop. No matter how small, how large your community across the nation, it's always a barbershop someplace close. So that was our avenue. We're going to bring that same concept to the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office with the help of Tanya Riven, who's our public information officer there. We have a barbershop inside the jail. So we're going to take that and create an avenue for conversation. We're going to create an avenue for an employment. And we're going to create an avenue for stability economically to these men and women. We're going to provide them jobs, you know, if it's through a barbershop. So these things are different. But as I told them, I'm going to be different. You know, you have to look at what we're doing and what was not being done by previous sheriffs.
One of the things you said off the air a few minutes ago was one of the things you'd like to see happen is conversations about how the community should interact with police. And a lot of the problems, at least just anecdotally from what I've seen in these videos that show up on television from time to time, is that much of what has followed in the video that has led to problems could have been avoided had people interacted in a reasonable manner with police and had police acted in a reasonable manner with people in the community. Is it a two-way street?
It is a two-way street. it is a two-way street, and we're going to help people get down that two-way street. When I came on, I talked about having a community engagement unit, which is going to be 12 to 8 detention officers and deputies working solely in the community each and every week, each and every day. We're going to truly engage with the community. We're going to have events, hopefully, every month. We have these conversations, but they're sporadic. After an incident, everybody comes to the forums. Everybody comes to the church. Everybody comes to the school, and they die away. I believe that the first one or two conversations that we have are going to be tough because people are going to want to vent, and we're going to allow them to vent, and we're going to allow them to say what they want to say. But then stick with us about the third event. We're going to build relationships. A lot of people talk about partnerships. That's a very easy word. You partner with me, and we partner. But I think building relationships are more important.
Do the people who need these conversations the most show up for them? Or is
no.
It, that's what I'm, okay.
Well, we're going to go to them. We're going to go.
How do you get them? How do you go to people who?
We go to them. We ask them to come. You know, the traditional things are the churches. Traditional things are.
Are the people most likely to be arrested by police going to be at those events or in churches?
We're going to allow them to help organize some of them events. You ask them, where do you want to meet? We meet them from where they are. If it's just a street corner and we got tables at the car wash, that's where we'll meet. Why not? If they don't want to come to the churches or they don't want to come to the schools.
But if I don't trust you to begin with, why would I want to meet with you?
Well, it's a chance. We're going to ask for the chance. We're going to have those conversations. We're not going to go and say you have to talk to us. We're going to gradually build these relationships over a period of time.
Other communities have done this, and it works.
It does work.
It works. You even want to talk to some people about how to video incidents with
yes.
police. What does that mean?
Well, how to video? Here's, you have people who want to video the activities of the police,
mm-hmm.
and they can, but how you do it will keep you out of jail. You know, if you are interfering with the arrest, if the officer is asking you to step back, step back. You know what to do and not to do. If the officer can't see the phone and another officer is approaching, that's going to be a problem. So we're going to have these scenarios, and we're going to have these, the do's and the don'ts, you know, activities showing you how to do it.
And you want to do this as the sheriff and with sheriff's deputies.
Yes.
It's essentially an extension of what you were doing for CMPD as a police officer.
That is correct.
What's the difference in the community with how they view sheriffs versus how they view police?
Well, they do. The community believes that the sheriffs cannot stop you. The community believes that the sheriff cannot arrest you.
You can?
Yes, we can.
Let me write that
yeah,
down.
Yeah, write that down. We can stop you. We can arrest you. We have the exact same powers.
Really?
Of CMPD. And we are the highest law in the land. And so most people don't know that. So we're going to even talk about that. My guys, love to say that my guys were out yesterday doing traffic stops on 77 and 85. And I'm sure that got a lot of attention, but this is their job. This is what they do.
Yeah.
We don't always have to serve papers or work in the courthouse. We're going to be different. We're going to be out and about.
Wow. I had no idea.
Well, if you get stopped, you know, just know that we can write you a ticket.
All right. Here's an email question. What is your opinion of youth gun violence? It's my conclusion, the writer says, that kids are playing with guns because our gun culture in America doesn't properly educate around safety and laws.
That is true. We're going to talk about that. Guns. You know, we're thinking that gun violence stops at the person who's purchasing the gun. No. How easy to get a gun? It is very easy to get a gun. Anytime there is a athletic event downtown, people leave their cars parked in the parking lot, and 9 times out of 10, well, like 50-50 chance there's a gun in a couple of those cars. And so then they break in them, and they get the gun, so the gun is on the street. So we're going to talk about gun violence, and we're going to talk about gun safety, and we're even going to talk to the adults about how to properly secure your guns in your homes and also your vehicles.
And we had a question about how you plan on improving prisoner rehabilitation, but only have 15 seconds.
We're going to talk to them and bring new programs. We're going to bring more than life skills, and we're going to bring in some more resources to our jails.
Well, you're in office for 4 years. I'm sure we'll get a chance to expand on your plan. plans for the future and the successes and or things you'll be learning over the course of the next 4 years. So come on back.
We hope the community just engage with us and give us a chance.
Gary McFadden, Mecklenburg County Sheriff, thanks for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.